This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Last week, the U.S. House passed the American Health Care Act, a partial repeal and replace of Obamacare. Not all Republicans are celebrating. Washington's Republican Congressman Dave Reichert from King and Pierce counties told me he voted no because we don't know how much the new law will cost. And we do know, he says, that it'll raise premiums for old people and people with pre-existing conditions, and it will cut Medicaid.
What impact will occur to the Medicaid population, and especially, again, to those disabled seniors and disabled and special needs children? Those are the people that really need the help, and there will be, obviously, less money to address those issues. And my fear is that because of that, the services could be reduced.
At a town hall for an Idaho Congress member, Raul Labrador, a panelist said people would die because of this health care bill, and the congressman said,
"That line is so indefensible. Nobody dies because they don't have access to health care."
What to make of all of this and more about President Trump's first few months? My next guests voted for President Trump. Peter Gigante works in international trade. Catherine Green is a travel writer. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you.
So that Washington congressman said this new health care law, if it stays intact in the Senate, would cut Medicaid. President Trump said he would never cut Medicaid. The Congressional Budget Office said that the earlier Republican health care bill would mean 24 million people losing their insurance. President Trump promised everyone's going to be covered. Who do you believe and why? Peter?
Well, I don't know where this is going to end up. I think it's still in the process. My personal feeling is that with regard to health care, I don't believe people with pre-existing conditions should pay higher rates. And we'll see how this thing shakes out. That's not the reason I voted for Trump. Healthcare was not the most important issue to me at all.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to Medicaid and how that may or may not overlap with some of the provisions of the healthcare plan, certain cuts in Medicare might be justified if they're already being addressed within the plan itself. So a cut here or an expansion in the program covering what otherwise would have been covered by Medicaid would justify a cut. I want to be careful not to brand cuts as necessarily a bad thing. But when it comes to pre-existing condition, I really feel that they shouldn't impact rates. And I feel pretty strongly about that. It's a long way to go before this health care plan is passed. Let's see what happens. And that's not the reason I voted for Trump to begin with.
Catherine, you were nodding your head somewhere in there.
I have to agree completely. I think this is one-fifth of the way there.
Mm-hmm.
So we really don't know what it is. Healthcare, what the actual measure is. It's actually a tax. It had to get out of the House, and I think that the Senate will probably make a pretty strong, good bill.
What is most important to you? What do you most want from President Trump?
Well, I wanted the Supreme Court justice. Mm-hmm. I'm like my other guest here, where I didn't agree necessarily with everything, but I had a priority of topics, and I voted on my top three.
Mm-hmm.
Same with me. Not necessarily the Supreme Court justice, but I think the trade and immigration and corporate tax rates, as insofar as they impact employment in our working class, and also immigration as it touches upon our national security. Those are the two main issues for me: is trade and immigration. But the corporate tax reduction, I think, is absolutely vital too to create jobs in our working class. Which I feel, if we don't do, our country's going to be in deep trouble.
On immigration, what has President Trump done that's been the most valuable to you?
Well, so far, I think it's still a work in progress. I think the overall strategy longer term is to develop a comprehensive immigration policy and implement it. So
while we're focused on deportations, you're saying the most important thing is a comprehensive reworking of immigration law?
Yeah, I think the there's a lot of fear mongering going on, and I just don't know that that's justified. I think if we all put our heads together and recognize that there is a problem that needs to be dealt with, and start together crafting solutions that work on a comprehensive basis, our country will be much better off.
Do you care about a border wall that Mexico pays for?
I do think our southern border needs to be secured. And you can talk about whether a wall is effective in doing that. I think it probably would be pretty effective.
Is it on the way?
Well, we'll see how that shakes out. But you know, I would hope that we can secure our borders more effectively than we've been doing over the past, you know, many years.
I ask Catherine about things like President Trump promising that everyone's going to be covered and saying that there's going to be a big, beautiful border wall and Mexico's going to pay for it. I remember during the election that some of Trump's supporters said, you and the media are taking Trump literally but not seriously. And you remember that?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you still think that's true? And what is it that you take seriously about President Trump and not literally? And why is that important?
I take seriously that he's going to enforce the laws that are on the books. And if they're the wrong...
Which laws are we talking about?
Immigration
mm-hmm.
laws. If they're the wrong laws, then we need to change the laws. But we can't pick and choose laws. The laws are there for a reason. As for the wall, is it figuratively a wall? Having been to Israel and Palestine, that's a really ugly, horrible thing. Would there be something that could protect the border, southern border, and make it so people couldn't come in as easily? That probably should be done.
What about you, Peter? Where do you take President Trump literally or seriously, and why does that matter? Because a lot of people are used to believing exactly what their politician says when running and governing.
A quick story just to answer your question. I remember back in 1980 when Reagan first became president, and he was underestimated by people because he had been an actor. And his first meeting with Paul Volcker, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Reagan said to Volcker, do we really even need a Fed? And of course, it completely floored Paul Volcker and just, you know, had his mouth drop. And a lot of people said, well, Reagan's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. If you take him literally, he sounds like an idiot. But what he's really saying is, you know, I have the control here. I can replace you. I could eliminate the Fed. I could do this, that, and the other thing. Let's keep things in perspective.
So why is that valuable?
I think it's valuable because I think the president, I think Trump, one way to keep everybody on their toes is to create a little mystique, create a little mystery about where you stand, especially with our foreign relations. Of course, obviously, clarity is important in some instances, but I think a little unpredictability is healthy.
Catherine, you're nodding again.
I think a little unpredictability goes a long way.
What's an example of that? Where do you see Trump's unpredictability and say, yes?
I think that he doesn't tell people exactly what he's thinking is actually very similar to the governing powers in the Middle East in the way they think. And so therefore, they quote unquote get him better than in a way we do. So my friends that I have in Turkey and Lebanon and...
As I said, you're a travel writer.
Yeah,
you travel
yeah.
a lot.
They think he's the greatest thing. They think he can actually help get rid of ISIS, which they think is a complete abomination. So a lot of Muslims think that ISIS has hijacked their religion. And I think that's pretty great if he could let them worship their religion the way they want it worshipped and not have people have the misunderstanding that ISIS is representing a large group of Muslims, which it's not.
You think President Trump or any administration can get rid of ISIS, pick your threat by bombing it? Because it seems like experience is that there are lots of, there's ISIS and there's Al-Qaeda, and are we fighting an ideology, or is this somebody we can just bomb into the Stone Age and declare victory? What do you want from President Trump?
I don't want him to do any one thing. I mean, bombing something to oblivion isn't going to solve the problem. Helping people have economic growth, to my other guest's point, mm-hmm. it's about economic trade and freedom. And not freedom, quote unquote, making everybody democratic, but the ability to work and trade and support your family and make a better life for your kids. That's how we actually take care of things in the Middle East. Mm-hmm.
Catherine, many of your family and friends voted for Hillary Clinton, and you voted for Obama in 2012. Have any of your friends or family come around to understanding your decision to vote for President Trump? Do they see what you see?
No, not at all. I told people I was coming on the show, and people spent 20 minutes trying to talk me out of it.
Which people?
My Hillary Clinton friends.
Oh, really?
You know, and I like listening to them, and they were somewhat polite listening to me, but most of the time was spent them correcting me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if we all could start talking to each other and have civil discourse, I think that we would actually have a better political climate, and maybe we could find that we're all, to some degree, trying to make a better world for our kids.
Peter, do you see any sign that anti-Trumpers are watching and learning and seeing the same kind of successes or potential that you seem to see in this president?
I'm hopeful, and that's the reason I'm here. I like she just said, I really feel, and I went to this symposium last week where they had asked a Trump supporter, 12 Trump supporters sitting eye to eye with people who didn't support Trump, and they asked questions, and they rotated like musical chairs. It was a three-hour deal. And I think as a result of that, everybody came away with the impression that we're really not that different after all. And so I think more dialogue is helping to bring people together. And I really don't think we're as far apart as people seem to feel.
I agree. I think the problem is we've been demonized and we're not given a chance to talk. And we want it good for everybody. We're not trying to say it's our way or the highway. I think we're both sides should be willing to compromise and come up with a good solution. Take a little of this, a little of that, and slowly but surely we'll find what works.
Is there anything about President Trump that I haven't given you that chance to say that you feel like you don't get the chance?
No, I mean, we could go on and on about different topics specifically, but I just think if people keep an open mind and listen to one another and talk to one another, it will be brought together. I do believe Trump is a moderate at heart, and I think over the next 4 years that will become more clear. You know, politics makes strange bedfellows, and I think...
Why wouldn't he make his moderateness clear now? What do you mean? It's not clear.
I think our system is so polarized. I think you've got to, in order to get anything done, you've got to work with one side and then the other and then kind of move back and forth. And not allowing people to know precisely where you stand is the only way of accomplishing anything. I think his true colors will reveal themselves by the end of his first term. And I think I'm willing to bet that he'll be one of our most effective presidents.
Agreed? Or you seem hesitant, Catherine.
I think the Trump that was on the political campaign was the man who was a king of marketing. And I think he wanted every single one of his speeches covered, 100%. And he did it. He was successful. The problem is what makes really good campaigning isn't the same thing that makes really good leadership and governance. So to your point, I think we have to give him a chance to see now how he's going to step up and lead. I'm thrilled that he got everybody to agree on a budget. I wanted him in the first 100 days to find any issue that everybody could agree on. So I'm thrilled.
You mean the temporary don't shut down the government budget?
Yeah, because I thought everybody was going to go to their corner on that.
Okay.
So I'm happy that they found some common ground, even if it's for a short amount of time, because I'd like them all to start working together. And I think it looks bad for the Democrats not to come up and say, we can work on this policy, let's work on it together, because we are all Americans.
Well, I think he has a history, though, in his business career of negotiating. He even literally wrote the book on negotiation. I think he's in his element as president. I think he's comfortable in the role. He's dealt with foreign leaders before in the business world. He's very comfortable, you know, hosting people to his estate in Florida and things like that. His good rapport with Xi Jinping. I think he's in his element, and I think that if there's anyone who has the ability to negotiate and find compromise, it's him. And that's what's required right now, because our system is so polarized, nothing will get done from either side unless you have somebody who's in there bobbing and weaving and taking things on in a compromised fashion. I think that's what will come out of this, is a set of policies that represents a true compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Let's give the president some more time and come back and do this again, okay? That's right. Love will
to.
You come back?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay, Catherine Green, travel writer. Peter Giganti works in international trade. Trump supporters then and now. And we'll give the president more time, and that's our time for today. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's KUOW's The Record with WNBA legend, Seattle Storm champion Sue Bird, because President Trump has said that you can get bored with winning. America's going to get bored with, we're going to win so much, we're going to be tired of winning. Sue Bird is an excellent person to ask about what winning is actually like. She's going to be coming in later this hour in about 20 minutes. Stay tuned. There is a crisis on the horizon for the manufacturing industry in the Kent Valley, because a lot of the most senior positions are held by older workers who are getting ready to retire all at about the same time. People call it the silver tsunami. It exists because we haven't trained a new workforce to replace them, and that failure has contributed to the decline of the middle class. For KUOW's Region of Boom reporting team, Joshua McNichols has the story.
Rocky Ward works for Omax, a company in Kent that makes machines. Her job is to hire new workers. But there aren't a lot of experienced workers to choose from these days, and it's only going to get worse.
Do you use the phrase silver tsunami?
Well, I'm there too, so yeah. I'm at that point. So, but a lot of us are still in the workforce because we love our jobs, and we worked for companies that really appreciate our skills. So my energy level and the way I love my job, that's what I put into recruiting people.
It's tough to recruit people for manufacturing jobs today because young people often don't think about manufacturing as something they want to do, even though it can pay well if you have the skills. So Ward keeps an eye out for unskilled people who she thinks make good long-term prospects.
You can go from a janitor to the president of a company, but you gotta have the desire. I keep coming back to desire and drive.
During job interviews, Ward looks for that special quality.
It's almost like they're bubbling over. They want to tell you about them and what they're capable of doing. They sit and they listen to what you're expecting from them, and then they just want to jump in and say, but I can do it if you just give me the chance. Nobody will give me the chance.
Every once in a while, Ward has an opening level position to offer someone like that. But usually, it's easier for manufacturers to hire workers who already have skills and degrees. You know, the kind of workers Boeing is laying off right now. Snapping up those workers might help manufacturers hold off their own silver tsunamis a little longer. But that won't solve the long-term problem.
I think we really need to look at the larger structural economic shifts that are happening to workers that affect their day-to-day life.
Polly Myers teaches history and labor at the University of Washington. She says the manufacturing industry has been through labor shortages before, and it's worth looking at history to see how we might solve the problem today. During World War II, for example, the shortage of labor forced Boeing to open the door to women. You know, Rosie the Riveter.
And so they began putting out ads that said things like, no skill needed. Housewives who've never worked a day in their life can begin to make a plane at Boeing and can enter with no experience whatsoever. And it's just like washing the dishes at home.
The government also responded to the labor shortage. After the war, federal programs like the GI Bill kept a supply of skilled workers flowing into manufacturing jobs. Those programs led to the rise of the middle class. Those programs are mostly gone now, and so is the middle class.
We're seeing people stuck at the lower ranks and not being able to move up.
For Myers, that's troubling.
What does it mean to live in a democratic society if people don't truly have equal opportunity?
Industry is changing slowly, making small investments in apprenticeship programs that help train people with fewer skills. But without the government more deeply involved, Meyer says those efforts probably won't rebuild the middle class. Meanwhile, Rocky Ward has a list of unfilled positions as long as her arm.
So if you're out there, I'm looking for you. Just call Rocky.
In Kent, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
And this is The Record on KUOW. Our Region of Boom team is reporting from the Kent Valley this month, and you will hear more of their stories online at KUOW.org. My name is Bill Radke. I'm glad you've tuned in today. I don't blame you if you don't think much about the dirt beneath your feet. David Montgomery is on it. He is professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington, a MacArthur Genius Award winner, and he's pondering that dirt for you because it turns out it's really important for the future of humans. Welcome, Professor. Were you at the Science March, by the way?
I was doing science up in Alaska.
Too busy doing the science.
Yeah, I actually was intending to be on the march and ended up having to do field work that weekend because it was the only weekend the rest of my colleagues could all converge on this outcrop in Alaska we had to go to. So I was marching in the field for science.
What would your sign have been at the March for Science?
Oh, boy, the rocks don't lie.
They do morph, though.
Oh, they do, and they change, and they get disrupted, and they get moved around, but they don't lie. They tell a good story if you know how to read it.
His latest story is Growing a Revolution, Bringing the World's Soil Back to Life.
Yep, bring our soil back to life.
What's the problem with our soil? Not everybody knows.
Yeah, you know, the degradation of agricultural soils is one of the biggest unreally recognized environmental problems we face today. But you can trace the history back to the dawn of agriculture, as I did in that book I wrote 10 years ago, Dirt, that traced the history of farming and how it had degraded agricultural soils. But if there's one resource that we are going to fundamentally depend on in the future that we don't talk a lot about conserving, It's soil. And why would that be? Well, it's dirt. You know, we walk around on it. We don't tend to think about it very much. But it's actually a really complex system that we're only learning to understand how it actually promotes the fertility that grows our crops.
What have we done to our dirt?
Well, you know, we've plowed it for centuries, which breaks up all the mycorrhizal fungi that help get those nutrients out of the rocks and into the crops so they can then get into us.
I thought plowing was great for crops.
Plowing is great for weed control. And so it's one of these iconic aspects of agriculture. You look at the seal of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the plow is right on there. Thomas Jefferson's plow, actually. He designed that one.
Jefferson can't do wrong.
And, you know, Jefferson actually had figured out two of the three key principles that I sort of like stumbled onto in researching this book, but he still plowed. But he also rotated crops and he planted cover crops. But one of the big problems with farming over the long run has been the degradation of land that comes with repeated plowing.
Okay. So plowing, also you talk about covering the soil.
Yeah, if you look back through the history of civilizations, one of the big problems we've had with our soil is eroding it all away.
Yeah.
You can look at trouble spots around the world, and many of them have a history of land degradation that made it hard to support a population, and people that are hungry and challenged in terms of their ability to feed a society tend not to be that stable.
How does good soil covering work?
Boy, well, you know, good, healthy, fertile soil is a complex mix of biology and geology. The biology we've come to realize in the last few decades is actually a critically and equally important component of it. And that's where the different kinds of farming practices, the kind that I talk about in the new book, really can help unlock the restoring the biology, bringing life back to the soil or soil back to life, because I do like puns. It's cultivating the beneficial biology that really is the key to a regenerative agriculture that can help reduce the environmental footprint of modern agriculture while maintaining our harvests. And if you think about how we're going to feed the world 50 years, 100 years, 500 years from now, we're not just going to have to feed 8, 9, 10 billion people. We're going to have to keep doing so. And that's where developing farming practices that regenerate soil fertility, even as we farm, would be truly revolutionary and critically important. And that's where I'm really excited about the kind of stuff I'm talking about in the new book, because I think there's a way to do it.
You talk about diversifying crop rotations. We have rotated crops for a long time. Not well?
Well, take Thomas Jefferson again. He rotated his crops and he grew cover crops, two out of the three key elements of a conservation agriculture that would work to regenerate soil fertility, but he also plowed. So it's putting those three pieces together in a single system where you're doing all three. You're ditching the plow, you're covering up the soil with cover crops, and you're diversifying a rotation so you're not just growing the same thing all the time or corn, soy, corn, soy, corn, soy. Getting those three pieces together to work as a system really cultivates the biology that can supplant our need for many of the agrochemicals that we use in modern agriculture today and can restore and rebuild fertility to the soil surprisingly fast.
You're listening to a MacArthur Genius. This is UW Professor David Montgomery, and we're talking about a soil health revolution here. This Seattle elite professor with his book learning goes to lecture some middle America farmers about this stuff. How's that go over?
You know, I went to talk about my original
long hair, too, by the way.
Yeah, I went to go talk about my original book, Dirt, and how plowing had undone civilization after civilization. And I was really worried what was going to happen. It was in Colby, Kansas, and it was an audience of almost all farmers. And I was like, okay, they can run me out of town before or after lunch. What's going to happen here? It turns out that after I got through the talk, the guy stood up, his hands in his pockets, sort of stared at me and said, you know, didn't think you'd really have much worth listening to say, but I've seen what you're talking about. You know, we've been degrading our soil, and you see it back over the course of a lifetime, but this is really important. At that point, I started to engage with farmers and going to conferences and starting to listen to what are the farmers that have actually been rebuilding fertility to their soil, restoring profitability to their farms. What have they been doing? What have they been doing that's different than what we think of as sort of normal and conventional modern agriculture? And I went around and talked to people who had done it, who had really run the experiment on their farm, and then tried to search for the generalities between them. And it turns out that there's a recipe for it.
I do want to talk about if anyone disagrees with you. First, will you tell us about your trip to North Dakota farms? what you learned?
Well, one of the things, one of the farmers I visited was a guy named Gabe Brown, who has a farm, a Brown Ranch in North Dakota. I'd seen him speak at conferences. I'd been told by colleagues, look, you just got to go see Gabe's soil. The story's in the dirt. And the first thing he did is he wanted to take me out to some of his neighbor's farms. So first we went to a farm that had, you know, the same soil. It's literally right next door. It had been no-tilled, so the minimal disturbance part of the equation was in place there, but they applied a lot of nitrogen fertilizer, a lot of pesticides, and it, the soil was kind of anemic. It was sort of a light brown. Try to dig a hole, and it's hard to dig into. It's crusty. Then he took me over to his organic farming neighbor's soil,
yeah.
And you know, the immediate difference you could tell is there were insects in the field. There were insects all over this field. The buzzing was like being in a tropical jungle. It was alive above ground. But that farmer was also tilled, and when you dug a hole into his soil, it was also dry and crusty, hard to dig into, sort of a powdery soil rather than having sort of a nice tilthy structure. And he then takes me to his fields that he's had as no-till for many years, that he's been planting cover crops in, that he diversifies his rotation. You push a shovel into that, it like glides into the ground. This like earthy smell comes out of the soil that was not on either of those other farms. You look at the shovel full, and it's shot through with holes and earthworm tracks and evidence of life. And he basically says, look, I haven't used inputs on this field for years because I don't need to.
Doesn't need the fertilizer.
Doesn't need the fertilizer. Occasionally, he'll use a little. Occasionally, he'll use a little herbicide if he needs it. And he basically says that makes his farm way more profitable, so he can produce food that's almost organic at a lower cost than conventional.
So what you're saying, ditch the plow, cover the soil, diversify crop rotations, that's news even to organic farmers?
You know, it's not news to every organic farmer. Permaculturists, for example, will go, oh, this is old school.
Yeah.
But if you go to big organic farms in California, a lot of them are plow-based. There's organic plow-based farms around here. The real question may not really be organic versus conventional agriculture. The real goal we ought to have in mind is agriculture that builds soil health.
Who doesn't want to hear what you're saying right now?
Boy, well, there's, you know, if you're in the business of selling chemical inputs to farmers, the message that I have in this book is not going to be welcome news, because I'm not trying to argue that we don't need fertilizer or we don't necessarily need agrochemicals, but I do firmly believe that we don't need to use anywhere near as much as we do to have a productive farming. And in fact, I would argue that's actually critical to our ability to maintain production over the long run, to actually lower our use of those inputs. So that would be the first people that would be upset would be them. And, you know, and they have an awful lot of influence. And asking anyone to change up their mode of doing things is difficult, especially when you're asking them to essentially turn their philosophy upside down.
So other than inertia and habit, why wouldn't a farmer say, oh, okay, I'll do those three things?
Well, there's also lack of knowledge in the sense of who do we have today advising farmers on how to farm? It's mostly their fertilizer dealer, mostly their chemical salespeople.
Okay, I see your problem, MacArthur Genius. I don't see enough money in your ideas.
Well, that actually is a huge problem, because how do you monetize getting somebody to switch up their practices?
Right.
You know, to change their habits. You know, what farmers need to know is that there are a different way of doing things and then how to adapt it for their region, their area. And that's not something you can monetize and put into a product and sell to people. One of the things I call for in the book, in the last chapter, is the development of demonstration farms that could actually adopt these practices in different regions and experiment with what would really work for the farmers in this area with these particular crops. There's no reason, given the magnitude of agricultural subsidies that we pursue as public policy in the U.S., we subsidize something like 60% of the crop insurance at present. Why not retool those to promote soil health building practices? Consider it an investment in the infrastructure of our soil and in our farming system, an investment in our farmers, the sort of original backbone of American democracy.
All right, we'll let them work on that. What are you doing at Town Hall tomorrow night?
Town Hall, it's the kickoff party and event for Growing a Revolution, bringing our soil back to life. And I'm going to talk about the book, tell about the journey around the world to learn these things, and also probably play a little bit of music ahead of time.
Music?
Yeah. One of the other guys from my band is going to come, and we're going to do a little two-piece thing as people come in and share some of the stuff we're working on for our next album.
What's your band like?
Well, it's called Big Dirt. It's kind of like Wilco-ish.
Nitty Gritty Dirt Band opening for you?
No, that would be too much dirt in one thing.
Yeah. It's a little on the nose. David Montgomery, professor of geomorphology in the Earth and Space Sciences Department at University of Washington. The book is Growing a Revolution. Thanks, Professor.
Great. Thank you.
The streets of lights where there's something old right beside me. Every time I walk the streets of lights where there's something old staring back at me. Said, oh.
Yeah, that was Big Dirt. That was MacArthur Genius's band, Professor David Montgomery. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Let's stay down around the Earth's surface now. If you ever wanted to follow a steelhead from the stream it was born into the open ocean, now you have your chance. There's a new online game called Survive the Sound, which is like Oregon Trail, except with real fish instead of computerized wagon trains. EarthFix reporter Eilish O'Neill headed out to Washington's Kitsap Peninsula to find out more.
It's late April, so juvenile salmon and steelhead are rushing down the Big Beef Creek, a stream that empties out into Puget Sound's Hood Canal. The smolts, as scientists call them, are trying to make it to the ocean. The first big barrier they encounter is a weir.
It's like a temporary dam with removable panels. So when the smolts are coming downstream, we'll put the panels in and force them to swim downstream through our trap.
Clayton Kinsel's a fish biologist with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife.
And all the fish, they're heading downstream to the ocean, go into the fan traps and into a live box where we're able to count them.
Most of those fish just get counted and then released, but not the steelhead. That's because, unlike most of Washington's migratory fish, Puget Sound steelhead are still declining. They've been listed as threatened since 2007. NOAA fish biologist Megan Moore says she's trying to figure out what's killing steelhead so scientists can develop a plan for their recovery.
We've been focused on trying to figure out what in the Puget Sound is causing these declines in survival that are not necessarily the same problems that are experienced by coho or chinook.
That's why this year, Moore is bringing 250 steelhead into the research station for surgery. Moore lifts each fish out of a tub of water, drops it into a solution that puts it to sleep, and then places it on the operating table.
You just make an incision, and then you insert the tag, and then we just do two sutures to close the wound.
The tags help scientists track the fish on their way out to the ocean.
When they're migrating through, you can determine which fish has made it to which point.
Normally, only scientists have the technology to track wildlife, but now the public can follow along and race each other's fish as the steelhead dodge barriers on their way out to the ocean. Lucas Hall is with the organization Long Live the Kings, which has invited the public to sponsor steelhead and then track their progress.
Between May 8th and May 19th, you'll be able to watch live on a map as your steelhead race for survival.
The Survive the Sound game is a real nail-biter because most steelhead don't make it. Some get stuck behind the Hood Canal Bridge. Others get eaten by harbor seals or other predators. Warming streams and lower summer flows have done in other juvenile fish. Two of the people playing the game are Ryan McFarland and his son Dylan. I met them at Ryan's law firm in downtown Seattle, where Dylan sat at a computer to choose a steelhead.
I saw a lot of steelhead fish. I choose Charles because I like the name.
Dylan says Jaws is little, and a fast little fish is more likely to be able to dodge seals and seagulls. Ryan says he takes his son out fishing most years, and he'd like to take him out to catch a steelhead someday. Right now, he can't, because there just aren't enough of them.
You know, it's a good thing to talk with Dylan about and to understand. You know, right now, 4 out of 5 fish will die, and part of the reason for the contest in the science is to try and increase the number of fish that make it out into the ocean.
For the next 2 weeks, you too can choose a steelhead to track all the way to the ocean. That is, if it doesn't get stuck at the Hood Canal Bridge or eaten by a seal. On the Kitsap Peninsula, I'm Eilish O'Neill.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Coming up in just a moment, Seattle Storm star Sue Bird tweeted the Martin Luther King Jr. quote, "There comes a time when silence is betrayal." So she'll tell you what she's being vocal about and whether she's paid a price for that speech. And we'll talk about other stuff, too. A two-time WNBA champ, four-time Olympic gold medalist Sue Bird of the Seattle Storm coming up. Stay with us. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I took my six-year-old daughter to a Seattle Storm game at Key Arena, and Seattle's star player kept scoring and scoring, and the crowd started chanting, "Super! Super! Super!" And my daughter started chanting, "Super! Super!" And even though I told her, "No, honey, it's Sue Bird," they're saying, "You will always be super to us. Thanks for coming in."
Thanks for having me.
Sue Bird of the Seattle Storm. And by the way, we just tweeted out, at KOW, Sue Bird hosting Between Two Birds, a la Zach Galifianakis in Between Two Ferns. How did that come about?
We do a lot of in-game entertainment, and we have a group of guys that...
In-game meaning like up on the board, on the big screen.
Jumbotron, So... We just have a group of guys that put together every year something new. If you go to Storm Games, you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, it's off the cuff. It's highly entertaining. Between Two Birds was just one of the years, you know, one of the season's entertainment. And I enjoy doing it.
The bird seed, nice touch.
Yeah.
talking to Sue Bird here, and I was just talking earlier in this show to some Donald Trump voters. And you know how Trump says America is going to do so much winning? We're going to do so much winning, you're going to get bored of winning.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought of you because you're an expert. Is that a thing that happens, bored with winning?
I can only speak for sports. And no, there's no such thing as being bored of winning. You know, I think from a sports perspective, when you're, especially on a team sport, I'm sure it's the same for individual sports, but team sports, it's, you know, bringing this group of women together, having this goal and achieving it. It goes beyond just, you know, a trophy or a ring. There's a whole process that's behind it. And the winning is just the reward for kind of doing it the right way. And I don't know how you get tired of that.
Well, because I wondered what was the most exciting victory you ever had? WNBA championship. Two of those, both in Seattle. Olympic gold medal, four of those. NCAA championship, high school championship, or the first time you beat your older sister one-on-one. What was the most exciting of all those things?
Well, that last one happened pretty quick. So I know.
Even though she's older.
She's 5 years older. Glad she's not listening right now.
Sorry, Jen.
Yeah. But it's tough to say, you know, because like I said, it's more about the journey and the process. I mean, a lot of times I can tell you more about the bus rides and the hard practices and maybe, you know, that time a teammate tripped or something stupid like that than I can tell you about the championship game or what the score was. I definitely can't tell you any of the scores. I can remember if they were close or not. But I can't tell you any of the stats, nothing like that. And that's why I'm saying it doesn't get tiring, because it's all about these other little things that make it memorable, make it enjoyable. And when you're with a group and you achieve that goal, I mean, it's something special. So I don't know. It's tough to pick one. They all have meaning in different ways, different journeys, if you will. And I'm just glad I've been able to be a part of all of that.
Are you ever going to go back home and play for New York or Connecticut like Marshawn Lynch is going back home to Oakland to finish his career?
Right. You know, I think for some athletes who have ties to their hometown or whatnot, who maybe got drafted, like myself, got drafted, you know, 3,000 miles away.
Yeah, you were drafted in Seattle.
Right, right.
Yeah, first pick, top pick, 2002, 15 years
ago.
Yeah,
a long time ago. I think there is a little bit of a pull there. You know, I think that does exist. I think people would be lying if they said it didn't. I would definitely be lying if I said it didn't. There's, you know, I now have two little nieces who are 4 and 2. And the idea, the thought of them coming to my home games, every home game, and cheering me on is pretty special. And it would be a unique opportunity. With that being said, for me, Seattle very much feels like home. So I don't.
Why? Because you just travel constantly. You play in Russia. You'll go overseas.
Right.
Why is Seattle even home to you? You're a suitcase person.
Yeah, I am. But ironically, I'm glad you brought up Russia. In some ways, Seattle, in terms of America, has been the only home I've known after 21. Huh. And you kind of grow up in the, I mean, do you grow up when you're young? Obviously, you grow up in college even. But from 21 to now I'm 36, this is where I've spent. I know Seattle way better than I know New York.
Really? What do you know?
In terms of an adult.
What's Seattle to you?
Like, Seattle's like my friends and, or not just my friends, new teammates come into town, their families come into town. I'm the first person they're asking, where should we go to dinner? What should I do? Where should I take them? What should I show them? And like I said, I'm not saying I know Seattle like the back of my hand, but I know it way better than any other city.
Where do you take them to dinner?
What kind of food do you like? That's usually my first question.
Good question.
Yeah, people obviously, you know, when you're in Seattle, you got to go for the seafood or maybe the sushi if that's what you're into. Mm. But yeah, so in a lot of ways, I feel like I grew up here. My adult years have been spent here in America. So for that reason, it does feel like home. And like I said, there's some pull there with my New York family and friends. But, you know, I started my career here and I feel really strongly about finishing it here.
I wanted to ask you about playing in Russia and overseas, because you don't make millions of dollars a year in the WNBA. So you finish your season and then you keep playing professionally. Does that wear you down? I know your knee hurts. And does it stop you from really improving your game? Because it's different playing games than it is working on your game in a gym.
Right.
What does it do to you?
So you can argue both sides of this. You know, I know some players that feel as if going overseas, like you were saying, prevents them from adding to their game, working on their game, you know, developing different parts of their game. But you can also make the argument that playing basketball, playing the game, and constantly being in different scenarios, I'm talking game scenarios, whether it's, you know, you're up two, you're down two, there's 2 seconds, there's 10, if you're constantly in those positions, that's also working on your game. That's also adding to your game. It's giving you an experience level, and it's keeping you sharp. And sometimes being sharp is half the battle. In terms of wearing your body down, yeah, I've had surgeries throughout. Unfortunately, I just had to have one recently, just a scope, nothing crazy. I've only been out a couple weeks because of it. Yeah, I mean, you can also get hurt, you know, I don't know that it, if you take care of yourself, it's more of a mental grind than a physical at times. You know, the physical, don't get me wrong, it plays a role. You got to be smart. You can't be stupid and be playing year round. That's just not, you have to take care of yourself, eat right, all those good things. But it's the mental part that I think can really wear you down. But I don't know. People ask me all the time, you know, oh, I have friends who are my age who played basketball at one point.
You're 37.
36.
36.
Oh, come on, right, man.
36.
I got a couple more months till 37. Let me have those. But yeah, they're my age and they played basketball in college and they're like, wow, 15 years later, you're still, I can't even imagine playing right now. You're still playing. And my response is, just like anything in terms of athletic and, or not athletic, but just in terms of working out, it's when you stop that's the problem. I just haven't stopped. And if you can kind of just stay on this one level and keep it going, you never get out of shape. You never have to get in shape. It's not as painful of a process. And that's what, to me, playing overseas is in terms of basketball. Because you never stop, you're always just kind of in this place of readiness. It's
right.
Kind of, it's weird, but I think it works, you know? And again, my main point is it's the mental part more than anything.
You, as I said, tweeted a photo of the whole Storm team in black t-shirts, and you tweeted the Martin Luther King Jr. quote, "There comes a time when silence is betrayal." So what do you want to be not silent about right now? You have a microphone.
Right. Well, in that scenario, you know, our entire league was not dealing with an issue, but things were, you know, last summer, things were getting heated in terms of just police brutality and, you know, the videos that were coming out. And, you know, as basketball players, as female basketball players, and when you look at, you know, the league as a whole, we're predominantly African American, and these were affecting people's lives in our league, and we have a platform. And I think it was discussed amongst all of us in the league, but really it was a team to team thing and what we wanted to do. And my team, including myself, felt very strongly about using our platform. And obviously, if anyone followed the story, there was a bunch of issues in terms of, you know, what you can and can't do on a WNBA court, what you can and can't wear. People were getting fined.
Is that different from the NBA?
No, it's very similar.
Okay.
It's very similar. What was happening was, you know, NBA, you know, you saw when they wore the I Can't Breathe t-shirts. Usually it seems like the NBA lets them get away with it one time, and then after that they fine. For us, we kept doing it, so then they had to not had to, but they threatened to fine us, which was a little ridiculous. But yeah, our team chose to just use that platform, and that's really where that all came from.
Have you ever paid a price for your politics?
Not really. I'm not that outspoken. I think I have, you know, some hard lines that I fall on the other side of one way or the other. But
why aren't you more outspoken?
I don't know that, you know, it's a tough question. I don't know that it's necessarily my personality. You know, I think the one thing about what we did with those black T-shirts is we were a group standing together. As an individual, I mean, I give people a ton of credit who are able to do that because I know for myself how hard that would be. And so there's something you said, you know, people talk, they like to see someone on TV, whether they're kneeling or whatnot, and they're very quick to judge. But you have to give so much respect to somebody who can do that on their own and stand up for something. I mean, that's, I don't know, that's I just have a ton of respect for it.
We're talking with WNBA legend, Seattle Storm star Sue Bird. Twitter wants to lighten things up a little.
Okay.
Twitter is asking, if you were a bird, what kind of bird would you be?
Oh, my God.
You can think on that.
Yeah,
I know that's
heavy.
Yeah,
I've never gotten this.
Yeah.
Man, that's a tough one. I feel like
is it
parakeet?
Larry Bird?
Larry Bird?
No.
That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say parakeet because they talk, but do they really?
Good question.
Yeah. Maybe either a fast one or one that, not like toucan. He seems kind of boring.
Okay.
He's got the nose.
Hummingbird is fast.
Yeah, those are fast.
Talking about the Sonics, you know, people keep saying, is the Key Arena good enough for them? This is the arena you play in all the time. How do you feel about that?
You know, it's not about basketball. I don't think this is a question about basketball. I think in terms of a basketball arena, it's perfect. It's the perfect size for what we're trying to do with the Seattle Storm in terms of the number that it holds. The building itself, I don't know, there's something about it where it just gets so loud in there. I don't know what it is. Is it the acoustics, the way it's built? I have no idea. But it's a great place. I think every seat, you know, is a good seat. There's no bad seat in the house. The times that we've gone to the finals and have sold out, it's been 17,000 people. It's, like I was saying, it's sold out. It's felt like, who even knows, 27,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
But like as I was saying, I don't think this is necessarily always a basketball question. You know, business comes into it. And now when you talk about the business side of things, it's not just how many does it fit, you know, seat. I think it becomes a matter of, you know, do fans, when they go there, do they feel like they're going to an event? Are they getting a VIP experience? Is whether it's the food, the plush seating, the suites. And then from there, that kind of trickles down to, it can anyway, in terms of the NBA. We don't have as much free agency movement.
Mm-hmm.
The NBA does, obviously. And things like arena and, you know, the luxuries of it all, that can play a role in recruiting. You know, obviously players aren't the ones sitting in the seats, but the locker room they have plays a role. You know, I mean, you talk about Mark Cuban and what he does with the Mavs, and you hear about their locker room.
I've never heard about their locker room.
Oh, my God. They have, like, amenities on amenities on amenities in these lockers. You know, my locker is like a wood block that I stick my stuff in. But I could imagine if I had a flat screen TV in there, it might be, you know, it might be something I'd go to a team for.
How do you feel about people wanting all that plushiness when you're the person doing the actual work?
You know, I think basketball has become a show. It's become, you know, a Broadway show. Think about how cramped you are in those seats. Gosh. But it's become like an event to attend. And with that, you want your customer to feel comfortable, and you want them to feel like they're getting a special something, whether it's the treatment, like I said, the VIP treatment, or just the show itself. And I think it all comes back to the business side of things.
What do you say to a Sonics fan who, you know, one of these people is just, they just need the Sonics back, and they've never been to a Storm game? What would you say to
them? You know, I'm actually not that mad at that. I think, I don't know. I think in my time, I've seen that people who are fans of certain sports, they are for various reasons. You know, I look at the Knicks. I grew up a Knicks fan. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm ride or die Knicks. And, you know, I go to those games, and I do have moments where I'll sit in at MSG, and there's still
Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, there's still 20,000 people in there, and they suck. You know.
Yeah.
But I realize that because I have a friend who's father has always had season tickets. His dad had season tickets. And I get that it has trickled down, and it's more than the Knicks. You know, it's this family thing. And that's just one reason. There's a bajillion reasons out there why people go. So those that are diehard about the Sonics, I get and aren't necessarily, doesn't necessarily mean they're diehard about basketball. And I'd venture to say those that are have come to Storm games, have watched us play. Those that are diehard and haven't, they're just dumb because they're listening to all the stereotypes about women's basketball and they buy in, they get on the bandwagon. There's something about women's basketball that, you know, I don't know. It's like, I always use this as an example. I don't like hockey. I kind of sort of watch it during the playoffs, just because it's the playoffs, kind of, sort of. If the Rangers are are in it, even better. But for the most part, I don't care. But that doesn't mean I go home at night and I like tweet how, you know, ugly they are, or how terrible they are, or like, who watches this dumb sport? And there's something about women's basketball that people feel the need to do that. I don't understand. I have my own theories, but there's something about that that drives me insane. So to those Sonics fans, I have a problem.
Sue Bird, we are literally out of time. I would love to ask you so much more. Storm opens the season on the road this Saturday, back in Seattle, home opener, Sunday, Key Arena, 4 o'clock against Indiana. You're going to be there?
I'll be there.
Playing? Okay. Sue Bird, basketball legend and Seattle Storm legend. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.